I think we'll start. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to it's my week six. I think it's week seven. But just before we start, just in terms of timetabling, we've got two more weeks. Next week, for this term that is, next week will be the last one we do on gratitude, and then in 2 weeks' time will be the Thursday before Rosh Hashanah. It is getting close. And we'll do a special one on Rosh Hashanah, drawing the various inspirational lessons from Rosh Hashanah as we do every year. So we're working on gratitude. We've talked about developing the consciousness and the mindset of having a mind of gratitude. Last week, we changed track a bit and we talked about the importance of gratitude, not for the person who has gratitude, but for the other person to whom we are expressing gratitude. And we spoke about the importance of being a support for other people and the responsibility that we have to give feedback to those that do positive things for us or have a positive impact upon us. So that was, because until now we've sort of talked about how important it is for us to be filled with gratitude and how it causes us happiness and it makes us better people. But it's not only about us, it's also about the people to whom we express gratitude and giving them that feedback. And as we spoke about last week, that everyone needs feedback, including the greatest of the great. And that was the whole session we did on Moses and how even he needed feedback. Otherwise, it caused a problem to the way he responded about the influence he was having over the Jewish people, right? Okay, so that we did at length last week. So today, I want to just go back to a concept that we started developing a number of weeks ago, where we talked about the strategies that we use to develop a positive mind, the strategies that we use to develop an attitude of always seeing the good, always seeing the positive. And we talked about various strategies. We talked about strategies like Mode Ani, the idea of beginning the day with gratitude, the idea of being conscious of the blessings that we have. And that was the idea of making blessings, which is always developing a focus and a consciousness of the good things that exist in our lives. We talked about the gratitude journal, writing down, making a list of blessings. We talked about the importance of verbally or in a written form to express gratitude, write those letters, write those emails, say the thank yous, etc. And we talked about a number of different strategies. But what I want to do today is develop this on another level and revisit some concepts to explore some of the things that make it very hard for us to develop that positive mind, to make it very hard for us to develop that consciousness of always noticing the good. And it's important to understand and to recognize what those things are, because that becomes part of the strategy. It becomes part of the strategy to make sure that we're not doing those things or we're moving away from those things that block that consciousness of always noticing good and always focusing on the light over the darkness or the opportunity over the challenge. And what I'm going to base the discussion on today is a piece written by a great sage, an author, an 11th century author who lived in Spain. His name was Rabbi Bachya ibn Pakuda. So it's a Sephardic name, obviously. And he wrote a very famous book called the Chovat HaLevavot, which is Duties of the Heart. And he has and it's divided into different gates, different sections. And one of the gates he has there is called the Gate of Reflection, Shar HaBchina. And in his introduction, he talks about the ability to notice God's blessings in the world, which is the same idea of noticing those things which are positive and notice those things that God gives us that are good and not taking them for granted. And he talks about three things and three reasons why it's so difficult for people to do that. And I'm going to base a discussion on what he writes, and we're going to branch out a little bit and talk about some other aspects of this discussion, but it's based on this piece. And he talks about this idea of realizing the goodness that comes from God and the value and understanding the value of all that we have. And as I said, he talks about the three reasons that block that consciousness. And in brief, the three reasons he talks about is, number one, is the immersion and the pursuit of physical and material pleasure. I'm going to develop this in a minute. The second is the need to graduate from a childhood type mentality. And the third is the misunderstanding that people have regarding the opportunity that exists somewhat sometimes in challenge, in the concept of challenge. So let's go through these three things. The first thing he talks about is that the immersion and the pursuit of physical and material pleasure. Now let's develop this properly. First of all, we need to understand that fundamental to Jewish thought is that God created a world with many things in it. And all of the various things that God created in His world are there for us to enjoy. Right? So, we're certainly not talking about a life where we detach ourselves and we don't take advantage of the things that God gives us to be able to enjoy. In fact, I've mentioned this before, but there's a concept in the Torah where there's the idea of the Nazarite. And the Nazarite is someone who temporarily embarks on a process and experience of abstinence, where he doesn't drink wine, and doesn't eat grapes, etc. And for a temporary time, perhaps it's a means to an end, and it's a good process, and in fact it's called holy, and it's an experience of holiness, but yet at the end of the process, the Torah obligates that individual to bring an atonement offering, an offering of atonement. And the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, actually talks about why is it so important, why does the person need to bring a sin offering, isn't he a holy person, didn't he embark on an experience of abstinence and detachment and holiness and purity. And the phrase that the Talmud uses is Dayach Masha Asrata Torah, which means it's enough what the Torah prohibits. And he had things which were available to him to enjoy part of God's creation, like wine and grapes, and he didn't, and that in itself is a sin. So it's not that we're not supposed to enjoy God's world. God's world was created for a purpose. God's world was created to enjoy it, not to refrain from it. But at the same time, and of course we pray and we wish everyone to be comfortable and to have the pleasures of life and to have the conveniences of life, etc. But at the same time, the immersion, when a person is completely obsessed and immersed in physical pleasure, just for the sake of physical pleasure, and the constant pursuit of material gain and material sort of success and material pleasure, that immersion in that process doesn't bring happiness. We know that. It doesn't bring happiness. In fact, not only doesn't it bring happiness, but it produces negativity. And it produces unhappiness. And because it produces unhappiness and negativity, that focus, that obsession, that immersion, actually blocks the path to the person developing the ability to develop gratitude and to focus on the positive. And why is that? So it's actually for a number of reasons. And here I'm branching out a little bit from the essay of Rabbeinu Bachaya, but I want to just sort of draw on other sources to explain this. First of all, as we mentioned a few weeks ago, and this we did just mention in passing, that a person is born with a strong sense of desire. And we need to learn to manage that desire. And therefore, when a person is immersed in pursuit of material and physical pleasure, an obvious thing happens, as the Talmud says, that he who has 100 wants 200, he who has 200 wants 400. It's a simple equation of life. We're never satisfied. If what we're pursuing is the success, the pleasure that we get out of whatever we can grab, then inevitably what happens is, the more we have, the more we want, and therefore we actually never really satisfy that hunger, we never really calm that need. Right? And therefore we're always unhappy. Rather than achieving happiness, we're actually unhappy. The second concept, of course, that the second result of being totally immersed and focused on material gain and material pleasure is that it produces jealousy. Because once our goal in life, once the focus is to develop and to succeed on a purely physical level, and success is measured by the ability to receive and to gain and to achieve greater material success, so therefore, of course, it pains us when someone else is able to achieve that success and we're not able to do it. And therefore, inevitably, it leads to what we know to be one of the most destructive personality traits, which is the concept of jealousy. And jealousy, of course, inevitably causes a person to be negative, not to focus on the positive. It's always about what I don't have. It's always about what someone else does have. It's always about what I could have that someone else managed to have. It's always about measuring the success by comparison to other people. Therefore, that person is more successful because they have more. If it's all measured by have, then of course, the jealousy sets in a very, very strong and severe way. And therefore, the negativity is tremendously pronounced. And it's impossible then to develop a mindset to focus on the positive. Which is, of course, why we have that famous saying in the Ethics of the Fathers, a zeu ashir, who is a truly wealthy person, he who is satisfied with his lot, right? In other words, the idea of being satisfied, it breeds happiness, and the opposite, of course, breeds unhappiness. The third reason that that happens is because it doesn't bring happiness, because, in fact, what happens is the opposite happens. In other words, when a person pursues pleasure, it is an interesting thought that this author writes in a different section. When a person pursues pleasure for the sake of pleasure, what ends up happening is he or she doesn't enjoy what they achieve. Why? You see, everything in the world, everything that's created, this is a Kabbalistic concept as well, everything that God created has what we call an outer shell and an inner essence. The outer shell is what it appears to be superficially, what it gives me superficially, what it looks like and feels like and tastes like superficially. That's okay. And then at the same time, everything that God created has an inner meaning, has an inner purpose. Okay. In other words, nothing exists. This is also in the Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, where nothing exists in this world that cannot be used to achieve a life of meaning. Everything that we have can be used as a means to achieve a life of purpose. In other words, the conveniences that we have, not only the spiritual things, but the physical things that we have, can be channeled, can be used to do good, to bring us rest so we can do kindness to other people, give us the comfort so we can focus on family time. Whatever it is, everything that we have can be used for meaning and purpose. In other words, the pleasure that we get from something is superficial. The convenience that something gives us, that's not the inner purpose of it. That's the superficial. In other words, when I achieve something that's purely physical, that I look at as a purely physical pleasure, that physical pleasure is only the outer layer of what that creation really is. But really, that particular object or that particular success or that particular achievement has a hidden inner essence that is the meaning and the purpose that I can use that object for. Am I making sense? Yeah? Okay. So therefore, he explains the following. You can only really enjoy something if you stop and reflect and take the time to invest in discovering the inner essence of what that thing is. And the problem is that a person who is completely focused and a person that is completely obsessed in pursuing the more physical pleasure that they can pursue, what they're really pursuing is the outer layer, the superficial appearance and layer of what that thing is. And as soon as they get it, they're on to the next thing. And therefore, they actually don't enjoy it. It doesn't bring them happiness. Because they never actually, you cannot really enjoy something unless you've got the whole thing. Unless you've captured the entire essence of what that thing is. So you don't really enjoy something, even purely material and purely physical, unless you give it some meaning. But if your whole essence is just to get the superficial outer layer and pleasure of that externality of that particular experience, then you're finished with it, you move on to the next thing, and you haven't actually taken the time to absorb its real meaning. And because you haven't taken the time to absorb its real meaning, you actually don't enjoy it. And that's part of the reason why pursuit and immersion in physical pleasure actually doesn't bring happiness. Now, we know that it's true it doesn't bring happiness. The question is why? So firstly, it's because a simple equation. One, if you have 100, you want 200. But it's also because you cannot really enjoy it because you're onto the next thing already. We don't take the time to absorb and to enjoy what we really have. And one can only really enjoy what one really has is to take it and dig a bit deeper and to understand not just its outer superficial pleasure that it gives us, but actually to discover what its real purpose is and to let it be a means to facilitate a deeper life of meaning. And that's why it doesn't bring happiness, and because it doesn't bring happiness, it brings negativity and it blocks the pathway to focusing on positive and to being a positive mind. That's the second reason. And the third reason that immersion in physical pursuit doesn't allow a person to develop a positive mind is this, and perhaps this is the main reason. And let's develop a little bit of a concept here. When a person is completely focused on selfish gain, on material gain for their own pleasure, what happens is that encourages a process where a person remains trapped and caught in who they are. Now let me explain this. See, the 101, the absolute basis of any area of personal growth, and I think this is true for any topic that we've ever discussed, right, is the willingness to change, right? The willingness to be someone who we were not till now. To be someone who's prepared to go out of our own comfort zone, to go out of our own bubble, our own perception, the way we've done till now, and to look and to explore something beyond ourselves. Right? That is the absolute foundation of every single area of personal growth. And if that's true with every area of personal growth, it's certainly true with developing a mindset of gratitude. Because as we said a few weeks ago, the default position of a human being, of most human beings, is that we don't tend to focus on the positive. We tend to focus on the negative for some reason. Right? The chances are, if you know that famous analogy, if you show a person a clean piece of cardboard with a black dot, everyone will notice the black dot. But that's what happens, right? We seem to take the good for granted, and it takes a lot of work and effort to notice the blessings, to notice those small things of good that are present every single day in every one of our lives, right? And therefore, the process of developing a mindset of gratitude, and therefore embarking on that process to always notice the positive, requires a willingness to shift, a willingness to go out of our default position, a willingness to go beyond who we normally are. You know, I remember once as a student in yeshiva in New York, and you know, certain lines and certain things stick in your memory forever. And I remember, I attended many, many, many hundreds of talks by the Lubavitcher Rebbe on a Shabbos when he would have like a Fabrangin. But I remember, and many of them are forgotten or need to restudy, but there's certain lines that stick in your mind. I'll never forget one Shabbos. In fact, it was in the month of Elul, and it was in the context of discussing the preparation to Rosh Hashanah. I don't remember the connection. But I remember one very cute line that he said, and he said the following. He talked about something that we talked about a few weeks ago, which is the idea of Mordei Ani, right? Starting the day with gratitude, which is the foundation of gratitude, that when you get up in the morning and we thank God for returning our soul, that in itself is an action. It's a statement, a pronouncement, and a commitment to gratitude. It's about noticing the good, noticing the fact that we are alive and thanking God for giving our soul back. So he said the following. He said that Mordei Ani was a very simple line, but I remember it stuck in my memory. He said Mordei Ani is the first line in the Siddur. If you open up a prayer book, you will see the first thing that happens in every prayer book, because it's the very beginning of the day, is Mordei Ani. So he said, if you ask someone, what is the very first sentence of the prayer book? What is the very first sentence any siddur? Most people answer, Mordei Ani. Because Mordei Ani is that statement that you say when you wake up in the morning. So he said, actually, if you examine it, it's a mistake. It's actually not the first sentence. There's a sentence that comes before Mordei Ani. And he said, what is that sentence? If you look in a prayer book, in most prayer books, there's a quote from the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, a little instruction in some prayer books in very fine print. And it says there, when you wake up in the morning, then you should say Mordei Ani. He said, that's a very, very powerful statement. Because when you wake up in the morning, that's the first thing in the Siddur. If you don't wake up, you can't begin the day with gratitude. If you remain asleep, the whole thing doesn't start. Right? If you insist in remaining in a sleep-type situation, then forget it. There's nothing to talk about. Right? So therefore, the first thing, the very, very first part of the day, is not to say Mordei Ani. The very, very first part of the day is to wake up. When you wake up and you're willing to transition from an experience of slumber to an experience of focus, then you can start with Madani. Right? And I think that's so true of every aspect of life. In other words, if a person wants to embark on a strategy, if you want to absorb some sort of lesson, if you want to learn from something or implement an inspiration that you heard and change a little bit, take one step forward, the first step is to be willing to do that. The first step is to be willing to acknowledge that the way I am now creates a prison around me. I'm in my own self-imposed prison, and we all are. That's the idea of the concept of being in Egypt, as we talked about before. And the number one step is the willingness to go beyond that, to go out of my prison. Once I have a willingness to become untrapped, I'm not sure if that's the correct word, but it's my word. If you're willing to untrap yourself, then we can start. Then we can move towards any area of personal growth. So therefore, we talk about gratitude, right? And we talk about that concept of developing a mindset to shift the way we look at the world, to stop noticing the bad and rather to notice the good, to stop focusing on the evil and to notice that which is good, and that which is positive, that which is an opportunity that requires a shift and it requires a commitment to untrap ourselves. Now, as human beings, of course, we can do this. As human beings, we can make that choice. And we do make that choice. You know, there's a fascinating piece. I've quoted this a number of times in this book, The How of Happiness by Sonia Lubomirsky. I think I got it right that time. Right. That in one of her first chapters, she quotes a fascinating study. Now, even the way she quotes it, it's fascinating. But what I'm going to share with you is that from a Jewish perspective, it's actually a lot broader than she says. And she talks about a study that they measured people's levels of happiness and what impacts on happiness. And they came up with a pie that they divided into three. Right? Something looks like this. I mean, in color. And they discovered, not surprisingly, but they discovered that 10% of what contributes to happiness, only 10%, has to do with the person's circumstances. Which is fascinating, right? In fact, they did a study, let me just find this, they did a study in America, and the study showed that the most wealthiest Americans, in other words, people earning more than $10 million annually, reported levels of personal happiness only slightly greater than the office staff and blue-collar workers that they employed, right? So, person's circumstances has very little to do with their happiness. It might contribute to convenience, to the things, to opportunities, but it doesn't contribute to happiness. Only 10% of it, right? 50% has to do with what she refers to as the set point. Set point means that every person is born with a certain disposition. So, it's true to say that some people are born with a disposition to gain more weight than others. Some people have a disposition to be more happy than others. Some people are born with a disposition to different personality traits. So therefore, they concluded in the study that 50% of the time, people's happiness levels has to do with the genetics, basically, where they're set point, with the way they're born. And 40% has to do with the decisions that they take. In other words, what they choose to do, the things they choose to focus on, the decisions they make, the attitudes they tend to develop. Okay. Now, that in itself is a staggering study. In other words, what it teaches us is that happiness has very little to do with what you have, but it's got to do much more with what you choose to do and your decisions that you make to be happy. The part, of course, I don't agree with the study is, from a Jewish point of view, is that 50% also doesn't have to affect you. Okay, it makes it harder. But from a Jewish point of view, there's no such thing as a set point. Meaning there is. There's a set point in terms of certainly people are born with different personalities than other, and therefore some people have greater challenges than other, right? But that set point can be completely overcome from a Jewish perspective. It's a fundamental concept in Torah thinking that we actually are not bound by any disposition that we're born with. We certainly are born with certain dispositions, and we certainly are influenced by environment, and we're influenced by upbringing, and we're influenced by all the things that take place around us, as we've spoken about many times, but we're not bound by it. Right? So therefore, happiness, therefore, even if 10% has to do with what the things, our circumstances, which is also not necessarily 100% set in stone, but let's even say it is, so therefore 90% really has to do with our decisions. It's just harder for the person that has a more difficult, a complicated set point, granted. But still, it's got to do with our decisions. We make that choice. We actually make that choice. It's an amazing thing. We make a choice to be happy or not to be happy. Because we make a choice whether to focus on the cardboard or to focus on the black dot. We make a choice whether to focus on the darkness or the light. Not that darkness light doesn't exist. It exists with everyone. But we make the choice what to focus on. And that's an amazing thing, to wake up in the morning and to understand that. And that's part of moderni, right? We wake up in the morning and we can make a commitment, or we try to make a commitment to be positive. We actually make a commitment to choose to focus on that which is positive rather than focus that on which is negative. However, that decision for a lot of people, perhaps for most people, is not an easy decision. It's not an easy choice. And that choice is a difficult, it requires a lot of effort. It requires a lot of reflection. It requires a lot of thinking. It requires a lot of verbalization and playing positive messages both in our minds and with our mouth. It requires hard work. And that hard work comes from the willingness not to remain trapped in who we are. Now, if that's true, if not to remain trapped in who we are is so critical to the pursuit of happiness and to developing a mindset of positivity, then we understand another angle of what the author writes, that pursuit of pleasure and pursuit of self-interest blocks the mind from developing that positive mindset. Because immersion in material pursuit for personal gain just further strengthens the person's self-interest and further digs us into being locked within ourselves. You follow? In other words, when we're immersed in the pleasures of life, all we focused on is us. If we focus on us, all it does is it strengthens that wall that's around us. It strengthens that jail that we find ourselves in many times. And that's the jail we have to break. It's the walls that we have to breach. It's that door that we have to unlock in order to go out of ourselves. And that requires a deeper thinking. It requires a deeper focus. It requires a readiness not to think so much about ourselves. Yes, we've got to take care of ourselves. Yes, we've got to be responsible. But the focus on self-interest, which comes from pursuit and immersion in material pleasure, blocks that whole focus. It blocks that whole mindset. And it just further makes us focus on ourselves. And the more we focus on ourselves, the harder it is to break out of who we are and to untrap our mindsets. You know, Wendy Mogul, the author of The Blessing of Longing and The Blessing of Skinny, a great parenting expert, says a fantastic thing. She talks about giving as a form, as a strategy to bring happiness. When you give, you're going out of yourself. And when you're going out of yourself, it's easy to become positive and be happy. And she says a beautiful thing. She says that if a person has a child, and let's say the child was going to do something. So the child, let's say, was going to play with a friend. I just thought this was a beautiful strategy. The child was going to play with a friend. And 10 minutes, the child's all excited, they're going to play with a friend. 10 minutes before the child goes to play with a friend, the phone goes. Child's unwell, can't make it, we're really sorry, we'll have to take a rain check on the play date. And the child is devastated, as a 7-year-old or 8-year-old would be, right? So she says, typically what would the parent do? The parent feels sorry for the child. So child is devastated, waited a few weeks to play with the child, so I want to cheer the child up. So what do? I'll take the child down to Glick's and buy him a milkshake. Or take him to a toy store and buy him a toy. She says, it's a terrible thing. All you're doing is making the child more unhappy. Why is the child unhappy? Because the child was going to get something that was going to make them happy, that was pleasurable. A play date is a good thing for a child. A child should enjoy it. Right. And what you're doing is you're allowing the child to escape deeper into him or herself. She suggests, if that would happen as an example, think of something that the child could do to distract the child in the form of giving, not absorbing more into themselves. She says, why don't you turn around to the child and say, wow, That's, you know, it's really sad that you couldn't play with your friend who's not well. Let's go to the store and buy a card so we can write a card, a get well card for that child so they'll feel better. I thought they were so clever. Because what you're teaching the child is, okay, things happen in life. It's just a little microcosm of what's more to come. We all have disappointments in life, right? Anyone doesn't have disappointments is not normal. So I haven't yet met a person in my limited experience that doesn't have disappointments. And we need to know how to handle them. So disappointments is the time of life where we need that strategy, where we need to dig in and find that reserve of will to be able to focus on positive and to find, well, there's an angle on this. Let's spin it. Let's find the goodness. Let's find the opportunity. Yeah, it happened. It was disappointing, but there must be a good angle. There must be a silver lining to this. And teaching the child to do that is by giving, by going out of themselves, not to become more absorbed in themselves. And that's why Rabbeinu Bachya writes that pursuit of pleasure and pursuit of personal gain, in other words, the obsession with it, the focus of it, doesn't bring happiness. It allows a person to focus on the negative and doesn't really enjoy it anyway. It doesn't bring happiness. And what it does is it allows the person to further sink and escape into themselves. Once you're into yourself, it's impossible to focus on the negative. Because focusing on positive requires a shift out of yourself. It requires a willingness to go beyond ourselves, to do what is not our default position. And therefore, what we should be doing is learning and embarking and engaging in strategies that allow us to go beyond ourselves rather than absorbing into ourselves. So all of those concepts are all part of the first reason he gives of why it's sometimes so difficult to focus on the positive. And of course, the idea is not just to understand the reason. It's not good enough just to understand the problem. You've got to do something about it. In other words, the idea is to shift away from that mindset and to live a life where, yes, of course, we achieve success and we hope to and we achieve that which is good for us, but we develop a mindset where that doesn't become our focus. Our focus becomes a bit more meaningful, purposeful, giving to others, going out of ourselves, so that we can develop that mindset of focusing on the positive. The second reason he gives is the concept of getting caught in the childhood mindset. And he makes a very simple but profound comment, and he says the following. He says that the divine design of the human being is that, of course, when we are very little, when we are children, we are completely dependent on our parents. Now, there's lots of reasons why that is, because it's different to animals, actually. Many animals are born very independent. And the question is always raised, why are human beings born that way? And there's many, many reasons for it. One of the reasons, of course, is that we're not born independent because we're born dependent on those people that should be our role models, and therefore we get taught how to do things and we get guided. And that's part of the reason that at the very beginning of our life, we're totally dependent. It's sort of called in, just like a baby has to develop as a fetus, there's a process that God designed where a baby has to develop and learn the ropes of life as an infant and as a toddler. But because, for whatever reason, God designed it to be that way, he also needed to put another very, very clever thing into the human design. And that is, he had to instill in the child a blindness almost to this dependence, and that the child shouldn't realize how dependent they actually are, and the child shouldn't realize how special it is that everything has been done for them. Why? Because could you imagine, I mean, it's an amazing thing, right? If you look at children who are the most dependent human beings, they're the most happy people. And not because everything's been done for them, because they don't worry. That's a crazy thing if you think about it. A child should be the one that should worry the most, right? Because they can't do it on their own. So if no one feeds them, they'll starve. So when we depend on other people and we worry that it might not happen, we're filled with worry. But a child isn't. Why? Because God removed that worry from them. So a child takes it for granted. And God designed the child in such a way that they should be totally dependent and yet not worry. In other words, a child knows with absolute certainty that the next meal is coming. A child knows that they'll be fed. A child knows they'll be clothed. A child knows they'll be put to bed. It's not certain. In fact, it's the least certain thing that exists. But nevertheless, a child knows it because God instilled that certainty. The problem is that what comes with it is that, once again, our default position is that we take things for granted. Because we're born that way. And that's the childhood experience. And therefore he says that's one of the reasons that people take things for granted, is because we were trained that way as children. And we are trained that way for a purpose. But the problem is, as in all childhood experiences, there are lots of things that... See, childhood is a very, very fascinating part of a person's development. There are lots of things that happen as a child that are meant to happen as a child, but are then meant to be removed. For example, another example of this is, and he doesn't give this, but another example of this concept is that a child is very self-centered. Why is a child self-centered? By divine design. Because God designed the child that the first part of our lives we should spend discovering who we are. And then as we get older, we can then enter into relationships with other people. Why do we need to discover first who we are? Because the human experience is only enhanced by real, deep and meaningful relationships. But the definition of a relationship is that it's two individuals, two strong individuals, who come together and don't dissolve as individuals. We've talked about this before. They retain their individuality. The individuality comes together and they learn from each other. Hopefully, and if it's a healthy relationship, they learn to support each other, learn from each other, expand into each other's world, and they become improved and better human beings by connecting to another reality, but at the same time, sustaining and maintaining their own individuality. And therefore, God designed a human being that for the first part of our lives, we actually become individuals. We learn to focus on ourselves. The problem is that when you grow up and you have to enter into relationships, the worst thing for a relationship is ego, right? And self-focus. And yet, so many people just can't get rid of the ego. Why can't they get rid of the ego? For the same reason. Because you're born with an ego, and you're born with an ego, a very strong ego, for the first part of your life, which is there for a purpose. So one of the points that he makes, and it's just a very important point of general life experience, is learning to graduate the childhood experience. Right? And many people don't graduate the childhood experience, and that's where everything breaks down. It's learning to understand that the way we were as children had its purpose, it was there for a reason, but as we grow older, it's about leaving behind the negatives of the childhood experience, maintaining the positives of the childhood experience, because there's a lot of positives of the purity and the simplicity and the happiness of a child that we actually have to try and hang on to. We all have a child within us, which is a good thing. But we need to leave behind and transition from the childhood experience to the adult experience. And it's actually a very difficult transition. And many people find it very difficult to make. And that's why it's important to mention, because it's important to understand where we come from to know what we have to graduate from and away from into a whole different form of reality. And finally, the third reason he gives is this. He says, one of the reasons that it's so difficult for people to focus on the positive is because people misunderstand the opportunity that is present in the concept of challenge. Meaning the following. As we always say when we talk about challenge, and I know it's repetitive, but it's important always to mention, we never wish for challenge. Right? Part of this, I've mentioned this before, part of the prayer book is that we pray to God not to test us because we're not sure if we'll pass the test. But having said that, we all get our tests, right? We all get challenges on some level or another. And what people fail to understand a lot of times is to understand that every challenge has an opportunity. We don't welcome the challenge. We don't want the challenge. We pray for the challenge to go away. But at the same time, we understand that the challenge has an opportunity on one way or another. What that means is that developing a mindset of positivity and always looking at the positive doesn't mean that we're naive. It doesn't mean that we don't feel the pain. It doesn't mean that we don't understand this challenge. It doesn't mean that we don't see that there's bad together with the good, or there's darkness together with the light. But part of focusing on the positive is not just ignoring the darkness to focus on the light, because it doesn't always work. The darkness is there, and the darkness needs to be dealt with. You see, we all have challenge in our life, and one level of developing a mindset of gratitude and positivity is to not focus on the darkness and to focus on the light. Not focus on the bad, but to focus on the good. That's only step one. Step two is to understand that there's good within the darkness. There's good within the challenge. Because if we don't do that, and if we don't learn how to do that, it becomes increasingly difficult to focus on the good and the positive, because the darkness will catch up with us. The challenge will catch up with us. Because it's there. It really is there. It's a reality. Right? And therefore, it's learning how to not to get stuck in the bad, but to focus on the good, but to also see the opportunity that is also even there in the bad, in the challenge. And just to explain this a little bit by a beautiful piece that I saw on this week's Torah portion, actually, by Rabbi Sacks, where in this week's Parsha, there's an interesting mitzvah. And the way it reads is as follows. Now, you have to understand the background, the context. The context is Moses is talking to the Jewish people 40 years after they left Egypt. 40 years after they went out of Egypt. It was talking to the generation that's about to go into Israel, the land of Israel. Right? That's the book of Deuteronomy, the book of Devarim. And he talks to a nation that is about to embark on a whole new experience, about to embark on a new lifestyle where they're going to have to work for their food, they're going to have to plow the fields and work for a living and live quite a relatively mundane lifestyle, different to the way they were in the desert. And in Deuteronomy, Moses has all kinds of things he does. He repeats many of the commandments that were given when the Jews left Egypt, and he also communicates new commandments that God has asked him to communicate to the Jewish people, and he prepares them for going into Israel. So one of the things he says to them in this week's Torah portion, this week's parasha, he says, do not hate an Edomite, because he is your brother. Do not hate an Egyptian, because you are a stranger in his land. Now, he gives them a mitzvah not to hate an Egyptian. He says, don't hate an Egyptian because you lived there for 210 years. So let's understand what this means. The Jews were in Egypt for 210 years. A great part of those 210 years, they were persecuted, enslaved. For the last 86 years, we taught that they suffered tremendous oppressive slavery. And then we're finally given the gift of being able to go free. Free both physically and symbolically, emotionally, spiritually, etc. 40 years, only 40 years later, Moses turns around to them and says, do not hate an Egyptian because you were a stranger in his land. What do you mean do not hate an Egyptian? They persecuted us, they enslaved us, they killed our sons, they tortured us, everything. Everything that could have happened to us happened to us. And we shouldn't hate them. Why? Because you lived there. You know, you lived there. So that in itself is an amazing lesson in gratitude. You have to have gratitude even for the small things. You know, we had where to live 210 years. We have to say thank you to the Egyptians. They tortured us. Okay, but at least we had where to live. That's on one level. But on another level, he explains very beautifully that actually it goes much deeper than that. First of all, no one can be really free if they're filled with hate, no matter how justified that hate is. Now, we've talked about this in the forgiveness sessions, if you remember, that of course you can't forgive people what they've done to other people, and also forgiving doesn't mean you agree, doesn't mean you accept, but forgiving does mean that you get rid of hate. Because when the Jews left Egypt and they became a free people, to be free means you have to stop hating. To be filled with resentment means to be trapped. To be filled with hate means to be in prison. And therefore, Moses tells them, do not hate an Egyptian. It's going to do you no good to hate an Egyptian because you were a stranger in their land. But then it goes a step further. So you can't hate because to be free means you shouldn't hate. So what should you do with it? But the bottom line is, I was there. He was talking to people who left when they were young, but they were there. They saw it. They saw the horrors. They saw the atrocities, they saw the oppression, they saw the slavery. So what do you mean don't hate them? How can that possibly be? So Rabbi Sacks, I don't know where he bases it on, but he quotes a beautiful idea. And he says what Moses really meant was, don't hate them because you were a stranger in their land. The fact that you were a stranger in the land, the fact that you were slaves in the land is a reality. What you're going to do with it now is up to you. And what you could do with it is, you could actually turn it around and use it rather than a vehicle for hate. You can use it as a process for good. How so? So he says, because this commandment is connected with many other commandments in the Torah. We find very often that the Torah will say things like, for example, one of the things the Torah says about how to treat a convert. Right? So someone converts to Judaism, and of course could be open to being insulted or treated with disrespect because, you know, they're a bit of a stranger, they're a foreigner. So the one of the verses of the Torah says, do not disrespect a convert because you were strangers in a land. Right? You were strangers in the land of Egypt. There's a whole string of mitzvot, of commandments when they're about to go into Israel, when the Torah says all kind of agricultural laws about leaving some wheat and giving charity and leaving part of the field for the less fortunate and leaving part of the grapes that you harvest on the vine for the poor. Why? It's all connected with the going out of Egypt because you need to learn from your experiences. You need to learn from what you went through. In other words, it's an amazingly deep idea. You went through it, that's a reality. It is dark, it is evil. There's no way to interpret it otherwise. There's no intrinsic good in being slaves in Egypt. Other than to be used as a vehicle not to trap you. In other words, you can be choose to be free, notwithstanding the negativity and notwithstanding the challenge. How so? You can turn it around rather than using it as an excuse to hate, rather than using it as a process for which you walk around the entire day filled with resentment and filled with negativity and filled with hate. You use it as a vehicle to use it as a focus, always, to know what not to do, to know how to develop compassion for other people because of what happened to you, to know how to be charitable and merciful to other people because you were a stranger, to know not to treat people with disrespect because you were treated with disrespect. So it becomes a learning experience, it becomes a training experience. And that is sometimes the meaning of understanding the opportunity that exists in challenge. Not always can you turn challenge into something positive, intrinsically. Because it might be negative, it might be just a bad thing. But you can use it as a vehicle to become a better person. You can use it as a vehicle, and notwithstanding the challenge, you're not filled with negativity. Notwithstanding the challenge, you use it out as a vehicle to do something positive. And that's the depth of what Moses was telling the Jewish people. Don't hate an Egyptian, because that just entraps you. That will make you a negative person. If you use the experience of the exile in Egypt just to become a negative person, then you are a negative person. It's impossible to focus on positive. It's impossible to achieve happiness. It's impossible to achieve gratitude. You cannot become a person that focuses on positive if you're filled with hate, legitimate hate, true hate, hate for something that was really evil. But it's hate, and it's bad for you, and it's negative, and you'll never become a positive person. But understand that you were a stranger in his land, so learn from that. Rather than hate, fill your heart with opportunities, fill your heart with strategies that helps you learn from that experience to move on and become a better person.
He also says, which is very good, Rabbi Sacks, he says, don't live in the past, live with the past.
With the past, right, yes. That's correct, very good, that's exactly. Yes. Excellent, that's that's a profound idea. In other words, it's understanding, learn with the past. In other words, live with the past, using the past as a vehicle to move you forward and be able to grow in a forward thing, and a very, very powerful idea. So therefore, this is the three things that this author of The Duties of the Heart says that stand in the way of becoming a positive person. The idea of immersion in material pursuit, it traps you, achieves unhappiness, it only makes you more and more negative. We need to move away from that and rather search for meaning and purpose rather than searching for the superficial and the pleasure. Learning how to move away from our childhood mindset, which isn't only relevant to this, it's relevant to all ideas in life. But understanding that it did exist and it is our default position because that's why we were born by divine design. And finally, understanding how to use challenge. Understanding that focusing on the positive doesn't only mean focusing on the good and ignoring the bad, but also means seeing the good that could come out of the challenge. I'll just share with you one little idea that I heard from someone last night, because I was actually discussing this with someone, and he told me a little cute thing. He said, maybe you're familiar with this, but he said there's a little story they tell about two people, which just emphasizes this idea. Two people that were two sons of an alcoholic. It was a person who was an alcoholic who destroyed their lives, as alcoholics tend to do sometimes. And he had two children, two sons. The one son became an amazingly stable, successful human being. And the other son followed in his father's footsteps and became a drunk and lost everything and just pursued a life of real emptiness and destruction. So one person was doing an analysis. How can there be two sons so different coming from the same father? So he went to interview them, and he interviewed the first one, and he said, how come you were so successful? To which the guy responded, he said, I had no choice. My father was an alcoholic. I had to move away from that. I had no choice. My father was an alcoholic. He went to the second son, he said, how come you ended up with such an empty life? He said, I had no choice. My father was an alcoholic. The alcoholic didn't change. The alcoholic is there. The bad is there. It all depends what you do with it. Next week, please God, we're going to just tie up a lot of the concepts to do with gratitude. And once again, in 2 weeks' time, we'll have a session on Rosh Hashanah. Have a wonderful week.